This program is brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM. If you like what you hear and want to support our work, please make a donation at fundraiser.resonance.fm.
Sendung Wellenlänge. Vous écoutez la transmission longueur d'onde. Udite la trasmissione lunghezza d'onde. You are hearing the transmission called wavelength.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM and www.resonancefm.com on the net. And today's guest is Dan Wilson. Good afternoon, Dan.
Hi, William.
And Wings of Garlic.
Wings of Garlic.
Is that right? Is that what I heard? I couldn't quite tell if that was...
Well, I thought it'd be appropriate for your show... because Maurice Sedon is a noted aficionado of garlic, and It seemed appropriate. And also...
So I wasn't mishearing. It does say Wings of Garlic. Yeah, reference to pizza, is that right?
Well, the artist is Son of Salami, also known as Joey Pizza Slice. He records a lot. He's a very prolific American recording artist who produces... he's a pioneer of this special technique known as the erasureless head recording method. And...
Erasers.
And he, what he does is he removes the eraser head from a tape recorder.
Right.
And he overdubs blindly, but he's got such a knack for rhythm and songcraft that he can kind of hear the progression of the melody in his head as he's recording. It's a very experimental way of recording sound. I'm not sure to what extent it was used in that particular track, which is a rarity, I think, one of his rarer pieces. That's why I selected it for your show, something that hasn't been heard or aired very often. I don't think that's the first.
Well, what's the advantage of it being eraserless? How does that sort of benefit the...
I've got no idea. it adds to the lo-fi charm, I think. And
it just gives it a certain quality. So it's not as though he's not recording... over a tape that has previously been recorded?
No, he is. So he records the rhythm track, the backing.
Yeah.
In fact, there's a great YouTube video called An Introduction to Erasureless Head Recording.
Right.
And that's available to view on YouTube by Joey Pizza Slice, a.k.a. Son of Salami.
Right.
And he gives a step-by-step guide on how it's done. So he lays down a first track just by recording basically... a drum track, and then using the eraserless recording method, he step by step goes through each note or rhythm, each quaver of the music, overdubbing sounds. So clicking in, clicking out, clicking in, clicking out, just recording blindly over it. I think the idea, the concept of eraserless head recording has been used by experimental people such as... in the 90s, I think Phil Niblock and Carsten Nicolai did soundscape recordings by removing the head of a tape recorder. So you're overdubbing lots of blind soundscapes, and you end up with a kind of mess of.
So it sounds like it's a kind of like a sort of double exposure. It's like double exposing a film.
Exactly.
But without necessarily planning exactly what. So there must be happy accidents then, is that the idea?
Exactly. Yeah, I think that's the idea. And also, it really saturates the tape. It creates quite an interesting low fidelity sound, which I think has something in common with. I know you play a lot of the Maurice Sedon tapes, where he has a telephone system where he clicks in, clicks out. Clicks in, clicks out the other person, so he won't be interrupted. So he's talking. He says when he's finished talking, he then allows the other person to speak on the phone by this homemade foot switch system, which I found is very similar to the Joey Pizza Slice recording method, because he's basically switching in, switching out, and as you say, double exposure, just like a double exposure on top of.
Well, some of the Sedon tapes. In fact, I did a program once of Sedon tapes, which was called Unerasable.
Oh.
And that was where he had presumed that the tape was erasing the original recording, but it hadn't.
Wow, I didn't know that. That's a perfect coincidence.
So you had a trace left. So he would be just having a telephone conversation with somebody. And in fact, he would go to a skip somewhere near Slough, and rescue these abandoned cassette tapes, most of which were Kurdistan music. And you can still hear the trace. So obviously his tape recorder was not erasing the sound as it should do. So you've got this very slight trace of this kind of thumping Kurdistani, almost like disco music underneath
his
straight voice. Yeah, I've got it. It's in the Wavelength archive.
Is it featured on the new Paradigm Discs release of Maurice?
No, there is not a... There isn't an unerasable tape in that.
Okay. Maybe batch, listeners, have you already told listeners about this release?
Well, I have, but we can tell them again. There is a new release, which actually Clive Graham of Paradigm Discs said it is to be released, in fact, today, although it's been around for a couple of weeks. February the 23rd is the official launch day of the Sedon Tapes, Volume 1, available from Paradigm Discs for £17.99. Or something like that. which you picked up a copy of recently.
Yeah, I did some of the segues on the side two.
Of course you did.
Editing them. But I wasn't aware of what they were separating or what was between linking material bits.
Yeah. I should add that you did the soundtrack for my latest film, which is about Hugh de la Cruz, called It's My Own Invention. And you helped me out with the Q&A at the recent premiere at Close Up Cinema, where we had to sort of fend off some fairly barbed questions, didn't we?
I was surprised. Well, they were only, actually, to be honest, there were only two kind of angles, or two. There was a two-pronged kind of assault, really, wasn't it? It wasn't really I think the audience took the experimental film as it is, which is a profound, inscrutable portrait of a very eccentric inventor. Eccentric you can use very lightly. I think he's got his own internal set of logic and rules, and possibly even he thinks he's invented perpetual motion. That's one of the core contentious points.
In fact, you've invented it.
I think it's possible.
You know more about it than he does.
I don't. I really don't. He lost when we visited him. Yeah. When I was collecting some of the ambiences of his house, he's got a very nice clock that makes a very slight humming noise and ticking noise. And so we were visiting him in Bow.
Bow. Yeah. Yes.
And he can talk very articulately on the history of perpetual motion. He's studied the literature up to a certain year. I think he won't.
It's about 1750, is it? Or something?
Yeah, he doesn't countenance modern additions to renewable energy, so solar power or the kinetic energy derived from like footsteps, or things like that. He doesn't talk about the electronic side. He's more interested in the classical mechanics idea of perpetual motion as a wheel, like the Bessler wheel, the Orpheus wheel, which is a kind of very old early 1700s concept. He's got lots of ideas, though. I mean, your film just documents one of his ideas, and he's got lots more. I mean, and actually, there were more than one. He talks about the trouser coat and
I mean, in fact, the first half of the film is about him and other things, but the people chose to sort of focus really on the second, the longest section, I suppose, which is about 40 minutes long. My concern was that would people tolerate the 40-minute section? Would it sort of would they remain engaged with it? Whereas, in fact, on the night, the two people that sort of had reservations or even objections was with the fact that they felt that one was kind of not exactly ridiculing, but they felt that it was a little bit cruel. Almost.
Well, this
the
was
word
the
cruel came up, which I object to. I don't think it's a cruel film. I mean, I have known him for 30 years, and in fact, I'm publicising his project, which is what he wants. He desperately wants somebody to engage with his idea, and it was only afterwards, or only fairly recently, that I remembered that Hugh actually figured on my first Wavelength program, which was in 2005, when he used a pseudonym. He called himself Alan Bridges because he wanted to remain anonymous. So I've been actually been promoting Hugh in one way or another since 2005. And in every case, he always ends up asking for assistance. It's like he wants somebody to help him finish off this invention.
Yeah.
So I don't think he's too hard done by the film, even if people laugh at him somewhat.
No, the main complaint was that this 50-minute section or 40-minute section was an almost entirely unedited pedestal for Hugh just to talk and ramble and generate ideas on the spot as well, and even correct himself and
contradict himself.
Lolly sticks, were they around the table?
Lolly sticks and rubber bands.
Yeah.
And there was one guy in the audience who seemed to think that I had that I was manipulating the audience, because at the end we do see diagrams, quite elaborate diagrams, and so this guy felt that he had been sort of led down the garden path to think that Hugh was a crank, only for it to be revealed at the end that there were these intricate diagrams, which wasn't the intention. I mean, I never intended to sort of lead people along this garden path to then say, well, look, now he's actually brighter than you realised.
Yeah, well, I've got this horrible feeling that part of that might be due to my soundtrack work, which is a very experimental and clunky and untested way of making music, which is what I call the post-electronic technique, where you try to apply the processes of electronic sound creation and manipulation to purely acoustic systems, which is sounds quite scientific, but it's more absurd in practice, because you end up looking in bins for baking trays and bits of grills and bicycle bits and cranks and pulleys and shafts and springs, and you're basically making you're foraging around in the physical world for electronic analogies in terms of modulation. I apply electromagnetic force fields to create feedback systems within these resonant structures, which are just basically piles of acoustically coupled junk. I don't know how else to describe it. There's probably a more
You mentioned electromagnetic. So in what sense is it post-electronic if you're using electromagnetism?
Because that's only the actuating principle to generate the sound. There's no actual signal processing involved. The only electronic element is the amplifier that feeds the electromagnetic resonators to resonate the ferric metal objects. So these feed, they're just generating... basically just making objects sing at their natural frequencies. They're feeding back upon themselves, and they can be coaxed into different modes of resonance by using gears and grazing obstructors and subharmonic generators like pitchfork prongs grazing against certain parts, very specific parts of objects, which then create harmonics. A bit like on a guitar string, when you touch a certain point on a guitar string and you get the harmonic. If you touch a certain part of a metal dish or graze a certain part of a metal dish, you then tease it into resonance a new harmonic. Hmm. The whole process of generating
are you deliberately trying to avoid electronic sounds as a reaction, or as a going back to primitivism or something? Or
there's a lot of talk now about upcycling. I don't call it upcycling. I just think it's because that's quite an ecologically loaded word. I've got ecological concerns, but originally it was just because I couldn't afford a synthesizer and I just wanted to make those kind of noises, chopsticks like taped to the edge of desks and things like that. Right. And then it evolved into this, and I thought actually, but there's a one.
Can you afford a synthesizer now?
Almost. I have got a few, but I just find them too goal orientated. You've got you just dial in the sound you want, and you've got it. With post electronic music, you can find things and get these completely unpremeditated sounds that you didn't realize you wanted. And it's like cooking. If you can actually change the whole direction of a recipe by suddenly you think, oh, this needs more pesto, and you suddenly you've opened up this new dimension. So it's very similar to cooking, I think. You're kind of resonating these structures, and then you think, oh, what would it sound like if I introduced these polystyrene bits?
But you, at all points, at all times, you are deliberately avoiding anything electronic. So
I'm avoiding all.
But but presumably, you record these things.
I record them, and there is opportunity to colour the sound by microphone placement. Like, for instance, if I'm speaking directly into this microphone, like here, you can hear the bass in my voice. And if I move slightly off mic, in fact, my microphone seems very quiet, actually. I don't know if your voice seems always louder than mine. But
right. I can turn yours up a bit. Is that better?
Yeah, kind of. I don't know. I'm not I'm not listening at home, so I don't know if that sounds any better.
Well, it sounds louder through my headphones now.
Okay.
Your voice.
No, I just noticed that now, actually, by moving around. But anyway, so you can apply some form of signal processing or an analogy of equalization by positioning a microphone around. But by doing that, you're in this caper of like a twister game, bending over and feeding microphones around and bending around, trying to find these positions in the air that seem to create nice sounding parts. It's a process of discovery that you, with a synthesizer, you just have in a knob, and you just turn the knob and you've got the sound, or a row of EQ bands. And in real life, you've got this infinite X, Y, and Z axis that you can just explore and go creative. You know, it seems a more intuitive way of making sound. But in practice, in the Hue film, in that long section, there's a big digression. The end result, I was trying to actually convey the sense of how Hue explains things when he says, right, now this is important, and then he forgets what it is, or it just goes, no, and then it doesn't go anywhere, and he moves something, and it doesn't quite...
Even though he's been doing it for 20 years or more.
I think he does...
There is this very strange sequence where he talks about, £1 up, £2 down, and he sort of levers his arm. He's using his arm like a lever to demonstrate something, and he mentions the fulcrum.
Yeah.
And that it's like £1 down, £2 up, and the fulcrum is £1. And he keeps going over this. He repeats this thing about five times, almost as though he still hasn't figured it out, even after 20 years.
Well, I think that's actually quite an interesting principle in its own right. When you re-sensitize yourself to the idea that on a seesaw, if you move the fulcrum, the pivotal point, off center, then you've got an enlargement of force. And this was explained. I sent Hue a copy of a book. I was in correspondence with him briefly, and I sent him a copy of the 1890 book by Wilkins called Mathematical Magic, which is full of diagrams of exactly what you described there, the pivotal seesaw with the £1 down,
right,
£2 up, with the off center pivot. And I think it's an interesting principle, and he goes over it a lot, though. I must say that
it's almost as though he's still wrestling with it. He hasn't quite, either he hasn't grasped it or...
No, I don't know about that. I think he has grasped it.
Or he's forgotten what he's supposed to be demonstrating. I'm beginning to sound like a critic of him now, but I don't want to sound critical of him. No. He seems to know what he's talking about.
But, no, I think the key to his idea is locked in that. That's like the natural principle at work in his theory. That's a central point to his perpetual motion idea, which he never actually discloses completely, because he's very keen on keeping certain parts secret, because he doesn't want people to run with the idea. And
But he also doesn't want Putin to have him abducted and killed, which is apparently one of his real concerns.
Well, it's true. I think if he had perpetual motion invented, there would be a...
But
strangely
enough, one of the people in the cafe afterwards who did think that the film was cruel actually agreed with that point. She sort of said, well, actually, if he did come up with something that worked, he possibly would be bumped off because it would undermine the whole oil industry, as he seems to think.
No, I completely agree. I think if he is onto something, then there's a price on his head.
But I think, what I liked about that whole long section, I think the combination of your soundtrack and the sort of reality of Hue talking, it takes on another kind of dimension for me. It becomes, you concentrate less on actually what he's saying and so on. It becomes almost like
meditation.
Actually, it's a little bit like the erasable business you were talking about. You've got a combination of things which produces a third sort of almost a happy accident, where you relax into it and you're just listening to this soundtrack and him talking and looking at him, And in the end, you don't care whether it makes sense anymore. You just want to sort of go with it.
Yeah.
A bit like sort of drone music or something.
Yeah, yeah. It's not entirely drone, but there's elements of drone in it. And he has got this method of just, I mean, you could say that whole section is just a long drone in the same way that one of those early morning Open University BBC Two programmes in the 80s was a...
Well, that's a good point. Yeah. So if you had one of those people talking about science, you know, for half an hour and then laid over some sort of electronic soundtrack over it, it would become like something else, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
It's no longer about the science.
And it becomes more intense as he goes on as well, because you realise you're going deeper into the rabbit hole and there's no way out. You're actually in his world now. This isn't a light-hearted...
Very glad you mentioned rabbit hole, because, of course, the title is It's My Own Invention, which is a chapter in Through the Looking Glass.
Oh, yeah.
That's where I got the idea from, because it's where Alice meets the White Knight.
Yeah.
And the White Knight is a sort of an inventor of sorts. He has various things on the horse with him. He has he's carrying a bag, which a box, actually, on his shoulder, which is a whole... The lid is on the bottom of it. So, of course, everything drops out. But he says it's that way round to keep the rain off. And then the horse has these spikes around its hooves to keep sharks away and so on. So it's all sort of in that realm of fantastical.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's a great title. And Hugh himself is like a Lewis Carroll character.
So is Morris as well. I mean, I used to think a bit like... Morris has always seemed a bit like the White Knight to me. Yeah. You feel like there are people that you encounter who are like sort of mysterious characters in a way. Who are out of the ordinary, such as yourself.
Oh.
but strangely, you also mentioned rabbit holes, and you sent me a picture of some rabbits that you were asking me as a book dealer to explain what this picture was.
Well, as I said, I scrounge a lot of components to build miraculous what I call miraculous agitation assemblies, post-electronic devices. I shouldn't have said miraculous agitation, because that leads down a new rabbit hole of having to explain. Basically, if you resonate something long enough, you can create an emergent effect, which then I call miraculous agitations, because it's like a miracle. You're creating a state of emergence from a very simple aggregate of systems. Anyway, it involves looking in bins, mostly charity shop bins, that they throw away a real variety of things. I just happened to find a framed 1920s nature photography portrait of some rabbits, and I thought you might know, being an art book dealer, you might recognize
the... So you sent me an image of these rabbits, and expected me to come up and tell you who the photographer was and where it originates from, and then you kind of got sort of exasperated, almost saying, you call yourself a book dealer and you don't recognize these rabbits.
I don't know anything about nature photography, and I'm just assuming there's a big culture of nature photography out there that I don't know about, and I thought you might be on the lapping at the peripheries of it somewhere.
My grandfather was a gamekeeper. I've got lots of photographs of him with sort of racks of rabbits hanging upside down that they'd shot in the dunes in Holland.
Did he do taxidermy?
No, they did have a stuffed squirrel on the desk, but but there were quite a lot of pictures of him. He was head gamekeeper in the dunes in Holland, and so shooting rabbits was actually quite a regular occurrence. So make of that what you will. So anyway, we should focus a bit on you, Dan, and you apparently had made an appeal on Facebook recently.
Well, actually, I should return to that. We went off on a big tangent, and I should say we were talking about Joey Pizza Slice and Son of Salami, who uses the erasureless head recording method, or he did. He pioneered it. Now he's kind of... he uses more advanced methods now, but that's one of his great... things. I think that's a really novel idea. I think he's the first person to actually apply it to songcraft, and he's a good crafter of songs. He's got a great melodic ear, and he's got a great knack for earworms, things that just stick in your head for a long time. And it was Joey Pizza Slice who actually selected the order of the tracks for the album on Feeding Tube Records. I should say that there's two LPs. There's the Misadventures on the Scorn Cycle on Public House Recordings.
Right.
And there's also This Should Not Be Happening, which is on Feeding Tube Records. And they constitute a kind of anthology of Meadowhouse material, which becomes progressively more depressing.
Meadowhouse being one of your pseudonyms, or your only this is your performing name, your nom de plume?
It doesn't lend itself well to performing because it's such a bland name, but the original idea behind Meadowhouse was not to produce music to sell, but it all emerged
and
from...
And in that you have succeeded.
But what, in selling music?
In not selling it.
Exactly. I've not succeeded
not
in selling
it.
That's actually quite a positive way of putting it. I've succeeded in not selling
you've
music.
Succeeded. Yes, you're a sort of successful failure in a way. I mean that in the best possible way.
Yeah, well, I'm interested. One of my key areas of study is in fouled histories of electronic music. And in the latest issue of Organized Sound, an academic journal, I've basically lumped together all my fouled PhD proposals to create this kind of overview of fouled histories.
Failed or fouled?
Fouled. Not fouled as in wildlife.
No, fouled.
Fouled. Fouled.
How are they fouled? You mean that's a strange use of the word fouled, isn't it?
Fouled histories. They're failures. They're people that failed to resonate into the historical continuum. They're, like you've got people like Johann Baptist Schalkenbach, and they were pioneers in bringing electricity and music to the stage in the 1860s. You've got his imitators, Carlo Bozza, and various other imitators, the Rousbys, and they're not in the history books. And the only way that they can be discovered, I found, is by kind of my kind of dabbling in the antiquarian book trade and just going to auction houses and even looking in bins in some cases and just finding programs of things that are ungoogleable, but with a bit more research, they do turn up in newspaper archives and things like that, and you can actually trace their history as a kind of unexcavated ground that hasn't really been examined by contemporary researchers. So failure is kind of something I'm interested in, but I don't want to dwell on it because I think it's a self-fulfilling prophecy, but it's too late now, I think.
Yes, you're well down the road to failure. Perhaps there's no turning back. Puts me in mind, there was a book by Leonard Cohen, isn't there, called Beautiful Losers. I wonder if is that kind of what you're heading
for? I really don't
for?
Want to go there. And these albums are the resistance to that. They're actually quite miserable. I mean, I've got to say, I'm making fun of it now, but the second album, the first album, Misadventures
on
the
School.
Is it because
you don't trust the idea of success? You think that if one of these records or songs became successful, that you would have lost artistic integrity in some way, that you think you'd sold out and become part of the, you know, you were.
I was trying to say, I mean, you can hear it on the first album. They're quite catchy pieces, I like to think, and well produced, given the limited means. But they actually came about through tape dropping, which is the act of leaving cassette tapes in public places for random people to find. And the songs are designed to be a bit spiky, a bit bristly, a bit prickly, to create a sense of inscrutable air.
Do you think we should play what track?
Go on then.
Should we play something off the... You've put them on a CD rather than... Or should I play track two?
Yeah.
Track two. Okay, let's...
This is actually an exclusive. This is not on any record. This is something that ended up on the cutting room floor.
Every walk down Times Street, see a load of people, no meat. Of the disaster, there's a toilet seat. Take the carbon monoxide treat. Shut your eyes and hope the world just blows up. Shut your eyes and hope the world just blows up. Bang. Looking indoors, finding something to iron out the floors. We're all whores, scrabbling over cascading floors. We're all whores, scrabbling over cascading floors. makeshift guillotine garden shears. Oh no, the end draws near. Days so very dreary, not so very cheery, cheery. Peeling off the scabs, peely, peely. Shut your eyes and the open world just blows up. Shut your eyes and the open world just blows up.
In fact, you corrected yourself. That apparently is on one of the...
That is, actually. I was completely wrong there. That was that was actually from This Should Not Be Happening, the album, which was curated by Joey Pizzaslice, who valiantly went through like a whole bucket load of unreleased material. And he happened to be depressed as he was doing this. And so there's a kind of double depression filter here. He was going through some of the most depressing Meadowhouse pieces and being depressed himself... arranged them in this quite ingenious order, which actually creates quite a nice story. The track you just heard was from This Should Not Be Happening, and it's called Every Walk Down Time the Street.
Right. Do you do the whole thing yourself? That's you singing,
yeah,
both voices and all the instruments and the production and the whole thing?
Yeah, yeah.
And do you produce them at home?
Yeah, yeah. Well, right. So I like trying to get the essence of a place as well. So there's, like, for instance, on Misadventures on the Scorn Cycle, there's the... hang on, let me have a look. What track it is?
It's the other LP.
I can't remember the titles. Temperamental Coffee Machine on the LP1 is recorded at college. It's inside a coffee machine.
Right.
And The Hermit, which is on... This Should Not Be Happening, it was recorded in a cupboard under the stairs, as the song suggests. It's about someone who's locked in a cupboard under the stairs. So I try to be a method actor in my recording locations. But actually, there's no acting. I shouldn't say there's acting, because it's quite serious, actually. I think it's been said that this second album is unlistenable because of its themes. I mean, you played something there which is a bit more benign, but every track in some way deals with suicide.
Oh.
And which isn't, it's quite a serious issue. And there's a disclaimer on the back, all tracks written and produced in dark times. And they were. I was actually wrong. As I was recording those in between 2006, 2010, I thought I was incredibly depressed. I was trying to transmute the depression into some kind of absurdity or something that's mildly entertaining, or even catharsis, even just venting. There's a lot of frustration in there as well, just venting the depression. But actually, there's a whole level of depression I was unaware of then, when actually it's like the difference between an analog television signal and a digital TV signal. You can get progressively more depressed, and like a digital signal, it just cuts off. There's a point where you can't record anymore. You haven't even got the energy to hit record on a tape recorder or a computer. You just don't produce anything. You've lost a creative signal, and it cuts off. It's not like an analog television signal where you can kind of just about do it, and you can. It just kind of there is a whole level of depression that was undreamt of while I was making those. I thought that was the worst it could get, but there is worse levels. Just considering donating the proceeds to some kind of
the Samaritans, perhaps.
Yeah, but it was put out by Feeding Tube. I think they get I don't know how they. It's too late now. So I shouldn't laugh at this.
No,
I don't know.
No,
I don't,
no, no, we shouldn't.
There's an
laugh.
Absurdity to it. It's
right. I mean, I have to. Now we've gone down this particular rabbit hole. I mean, are you suicidal?
Well, there was moments. I mean, I remember walking over a bridge and just looking down, thinking I could just jump in there and end all this. Like the awfulness of everything is just unbearable. It's not.
This is dreadful, Dan. I'm
sorry.
Sorry. This is awful. I mean, you strike me as being a cheerful chap.
Well, thankfully,
you've done the soundtrack for the film, and you've produced these LPs, which are. I mean, you do interesting work.
Yeah, but it doesn't do anything. And, you know, it's like the failure thing you were talking about. It's like the continuous having to change perspective and fire things at different angles, job applications, even things simple as just volunteering at charity shops when you're not allowed to even volunteer. You think, what the hell's going on? I can't even get an unpaid internship somewhere, an unskilled position. And it is incredibly depressing. And I think...
But do you think, would it lessen the depression if you achieved that? I mean, if you got the job as an intern at the charity shop, Do you actually think that that would make you feel better?
Yeah, I think being active and doing... I mean, I can't offer any advice. I don't know how depression comes and goes. I try to do things to transmute the energy, because it is a form of energy. Depression is something. It seems to fit. It's an emotion, and all emotions can kind of be woven. You can kind of force them into different directions. I think depression is probably the most difficult one to actually manipulate and get rid of, but there's a sense of the grass is always greener on the other side. So maybe you're right that if I did get the internship, it wouldn't be any better. But I strongly suspect that when you're busy and doing something, that you don't get to dwell on these.
But you're
things.
Very active. You do things.
I think
you have a workshop at home in which you create music.
Well, not at the moment. The workshop is just full of like dead relatives. Belongings.
So, I thought you were going to say
just
I had to wait for the belongings to be added. So dead relatives belong.
This is really bad taste.
How many relatives have died? Sorry.
I don't want to talk about that. It's too depressing.
Seriously, how many relatives have died?
Well, over the years, there have been three.
And they're all their belongings are in your studio.
Well, they're all being... They're just in boxes. There's like sentimental attachment to them. And I don't know. I haven't got any sentimental attachment to them, but they're all... They're piled up there. And I do record in other places. I am a big fan of on-location recording. In fact, there's an article in the latest Wire magazine on symphony, which is a kind of my attempt to define the intangible essence of place that you get when you record on location somewhere. The idea is a kind of romantic idea that Chris Watson really is kind of the figurehead for this concept, that he believes that somehow the acoustics of a place, or just the mere quantum essence of a place, can somehow be ingrained in the sound, and all the ideas and the history of the place that and everything that occurred there is somehow embodied in the sound. It's a very spurious concept, but there's actually a sub history that can be traced in like the BBC's radio telepathy experiments of the 1920s, and this is all in the latest Wire magazine. But sorry, this is a big digression, but the idea is that on location recording appeals to me. Like if you're going to record something about someone hiding under the stairs, then you record it under the stairs. Or if you record something about a temperamental coffee machine, you record it inside a temperamental coffee machine.
Yeah.
You physically get inside the coffee machine.
Right.
And just pluck strings across, stretch
across. Shall we play another track?
Yeah.
What do you think?
Go random.
Go random. Track 7 is a huge thing, isn't it?
Yeah,
should we move away from that? We should try and promote. I think we should try and promote your albums. You've got two albums out now. Meadowhouse, Dan Wilson, buy his records, please. One is called Misadventures on the Scorn Cycle.
That's the happier one.
That's the happier one.
I was a lot younger when I did that.
And then the other one is called This Should Not Be Happening. But both of vinyl. How would anyone buy your music?
Well, if you're in London, you can pick up copies at the Pleasures of Past Times bookshop, an excellent book and record shop on
Cecil Court.
Cecil Court Road, just off Leicester Square, or in the Leicester Square area, off Charing Cross Road.
Yeah.
And there are a few copies left there. Otherwise, you can buy online.
Okay.
Although I think it'll be cheaper if you go to that shop.
How would they find it online? Just go to Meadowhouse Records or something?
Well, it's on Boomcat.
But do you get money out of Boomcat? Or is it free downloads or whatever?
I don't know. It comes to me somehow.
Okay. So what do you? We'll play another track in a minute. But what are you hoping for? What do you want to? What do you want to sell more records?
I just think this is my kind of my final word on tape dropping. Now that the practice is actually untenable, you can't drop cassettes anymore, or even CDRs. I think the days of media.
But that kind of activity is something that would give you artistic kudos, right? It's almost like a conceptual art piece. But it is doomed to fail, isn't it? Because
not necessarily. Well, it is now.
But nobody would actually know that you had done it.
And, you're thinking of it in terms of in kind of entrepreneurial terms.
I'm trying to sort of steer you away from what seems to be a kind of cul-de-sac.
I'm out the cul-de-sac. I should say that tape dropping is now a pursuit that can't be done, because the very people that I hope to reach by tape dropping are the people that aren't necessarily interested in experimental music. I'm trying to romance them into experimental music almost, or just produce challenging sonics that can be appreciated on some level. But the idea was behind tape dropping that you could drop a cassette with an email address provided on the cassette, and then you can harvest responses from these cassettes, and knowing that what was on the cassette, what kind of material was on the cassette, you can then gauge what kind of sound and what kind of song or what kind of what kind of content elicits the most response.
Was this a rewarding activity for you?
I think it was rewarding when people were listening, but gradually, I think by about 2005, 2006, nobody picked up cassettes anymore. And by then, the cassette was obsolete as a media format. I don't think ordinary...
But it's made a comeback, hasn't it?
It has, but the people that now take the tape mantle are kind of too knowing to be. They're quite hip people that have cassette players now. So the people that I try to reach through tape dropping aren't necessarily one.
But then that's failure again, isn't it? Because it almost has to be hip to succeed.
That's very true, and I think actually there's a kind of hip tyranny now almost.
So if you deliberately bypass or anticipate that which is hip, you're always going to be in a hole.
Yeah, well, when I look at the back of this one, for instance, Misadventures on the Scorn Cycle, there's tracks called Minga, which is, I think nowadays, people would look at that. I mean, it was composed in 2004. This is the 2008 version. But 2004, you have to bear in mind that the word Minga is now loaded with... it's not politically
not
correct.
Acceptable.
And rightly so. This is the idea of the song. I should give a bit of background to the song, which is actually on the CD. Maybe you can randomly
How will I find it?
I've got no idea what track it is, but let me explain it first, because I need to put a disclaimer in here. The word Minga was used by Vernon Ward. Vernon, who's the presenter of Boys and Girls 2004, a trash TV
show? Never heard of it.
Vernon Ward, who's Vernon Ward?
I have no idea.
Not Vernon Wood. I don't know who Vernon Kay. Okay. He on Channel 4, he presented Boys and Girls, which introduced a segment called Babe or Minga. And in that section, members of the audience would be chosen, and then they'd be voted on their appearance. And to me at the time, that was a form of complete eugenics. It was completely outrageous to me. It was disgusting. I was like an early adopter of this. Everyone loved it. It seemed to be a kind of culturally accepted thing. I was quite young, I remember. I was in teens or 20, early 20s, I suppose.
You found it offensive?
And so I made this song to kind of...
To highlight this?
Not necessarily to highlight it, but to draw attention to the absolute absurdity of the thing, and also kind of wallow in a sentiment, because the culture at the time wasn't... You have to, you know... Oh, I don't... I play it and see...
Oh, please don't cock a snook. The eyes are good, the face is wrong. Mouth is saggy, mind is gone. Chin of tramp, the face is long. Spots the size of toes. That's just the way it grows. Everyone should know. I wish I was a garden gnome. Boys say ho, ho, ho. And the girls say no, no, no. Picking off off the scabs. See no evil, see no evil. There's a brand new game show where the people take pot shots from their ivory towers at the minas below. Got to blow the fumes right out of the face. Got to give the cynics a blue-green taste. Mustn't let the mind of me go to waste. Got to blow the fumes right out of the face. Oh, please don't point that finger when you're in the street. Just walk on over to me and pick the scabs off me. Sing a happy song for everyone's a boo. Blister finger, verbal abuse from whinging don't know who's. Got to blow the blues right out of the face. Got to give the cynics a blue green taste. Doesn't let the mind and ego to waste. So blow the blues right out of the face. When happiness is mine, I'll smile all the time. Until that day arrives, I'll just be wretched.
Say that you're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM, and today's guest is Dan Wilson, performing under the name Meadow House. And you're here, Dan, with your two vinyl LPs.
Yes, trying to sell them.
Trying to promote them.
Raise interest, raise and rouse emotions.
Against the odds, I think. Yeah. But yes, you've done very well so far. You wanted to say a bit more about...
Well, I didn't explain it very well. I should have said that we were talking about hipness.
Yes.
And there's some things here which I think now, in the last 5 years, there's been a kind of sea change in what's acceptable and what's not. And there's one track called Unreconstruction's Busty Binary Yesterday Song, which kind of plays out like one of those, what's those sex comedies, Confessions of a Robin Asquith type 70s stuff, you know, the Confessions of a Window Cleaner stuff, which is completely... rubbish.
Yes.
Sorry, more acceptable, radio friendly. I kind of resisted that, but actually I don't, because they are kind of, some of them are in first person, yeah, to kind of I don't know what to say. There's a feeling now that there's potential malice embedded in inscrutable pieces of works of art. Even I wouldn't call this a work of art. These are quite earthy nuggets, I think. They're not. I don't have any pretensions to high art on these records, but it's like what you're saying about your Hugh film, and that section where sections of the audience believed it was a cruel portrayal of this eccentric inventor. And I think you can be inscrutable with, you've got a right to be inscrutable, but It can be misinterpreted nowadays.
Right.
I don't know if that's...
Yeah. I feel that I'm presenting him as he is. I suppose the question is, would he want to be seen that way?
You do amplify his eccentricity slightly, though, because you're actually... The film is through the filter of your own perception, and you're picking up on
that's
all the
true.
Particularly... characterful parts of his life, which is a kind of filtering process.
But I think things like that only become cruel or objectionable, I think, if the person that you are portraying is somehow unaware of what you're doing. Then it becomes like a sleight of hand. It's like you've tricked them in some way.
Yeah,
and you're doing something to them that they don't understand, and now the public are laughing at them or seeing them in a certain way, which they possibly weren't aware of when you were filming them. But in his case, all of this is outweighed by the fact that he actually wants to gain exposure.
And he's fully aware of how you...
he does laugh at himself a bit.
The thing I keep talking about is that he's like, you were his employer.
Yeah.
But you were like 10 years younger than him. And yes. So being...
No, not 10 years. Okay, but anyway, I'm younger. Yeah.
All right. But the point is, imagine being... having a boss that's younger than you.
Yes.
He's got this kind of, he wants to project chaos on you. You know, it's not resentment, but I feel that there's a kind of a bristliness that just, it's fun. It's not, it's a kind of, he's got nothing to, there's no pretense. If you've got a boss that's younger than you, you can kind of, you can be a bit belligerent in your actions.
Right. I suppose that's true.
And I get the impression that's how he is with you.
Right, right. I mean, I would say, in effect, I have, support is a bit strong, but certainly, I suppose support is the only word I can think of. Yeah. For about 30 years, actually. Yeah. It's sort of, I don't want to go into that. We haven't got time to go into all of that now.
Yeah.
But there have been various instances throughout his life where I've been helpful to him, shall we say.
Yeah.
So whether that justifies making a film where people find him amusing, I don't know.
He was very... I mean, he wants people to know about his work, though.
That's true.
Certainly if I was Hugh, I'd be...
And I think I've done more for that than anybody else alive, in fact. In terms of, contacting people and so on. Anyway,
I should say one more thing, that if anyone wants a true benchmark of cruelty now, there's an American YouTuber or presenter on some cable television called Tosh Zero, really does exploit his subjects in quite a despicable way. And,
right. But we don't want to be compared to that.
No, we don't.
We don't want to even have that on the radar. Really.
Yeah, yeah. Bringing that up. But that's a complete diametrically opposite of what we're doing here, which is a respectful...
Exactly.
Yeah.
And, okay. Well, thank you very much to Dan Wilson for coming in.
No, thanks for having me.
And... you're appealing on Facebook for people to... I mean, you sounded fairly desperate, I must admit.
I just thought, well, I want to do justice to the labels and, sell a few. I'm surprised at how little interest there is. It's a tape dropping to me. It seems like I'm surprised reviewers haven't run with the idea that there's... The idea of dropping cassettes in public is quite a novel way of distributing music.
We've got time. We're going to play a bit from... This is track one from which LP?
Misadventures on the Scorn Cycle.
And this is actually from the LP itself we're playing now, not the CD. So this might just about take us up to the end, but we'll see.
Thank you.
30 seconds left, Dan. What was that track?
That was called The Magician's Apprentice.
And that's from?
Misadventures on the Scorn Cycle on Public House Recordings.
Okay, you've been listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM with today's guest, Dan Wilson, of Meadow House.
And Oscillatorial Binage.
And Oscillatorial Binage. Yep. Oh, well, you've snuck that one in. That
the electroacoustic.
At the very last minute.
This program has been brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM. If you liked what you heard and want to support our work, please make a donation at fundraiser.resonance.fm.